and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I like to call it, Dear Matt and Hank.
Hey, Matthew Gatos is here.
I'm here.
This is a comedy podcast about death where we dispense dubious advice, usually me and my brother, but sometimes me and a special guest. We also will bring you the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. Matthew Gatos.
Yes.
How are you? But also, who are you?
The better question, who am I?
Why are you? Why?
Why am I? Why?
Yeah, sorry.
I am Matthew Gatos. I am a producer at your video making company, Complexly.
And you've been a video making person for a long time. And
yeah,
people,
I make
people
YouTube.
Know you from your internet things.
Yeah, I make YouTube videos on my own channel as well.
Yeah.
But I get paid to make YouTube videos for Sexplanations and Animal Wonders and The Financial Diet.
Yes. Well, thank you. We've been friends for a long time.
Yeah, it's been about 4 years since I moved out here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we knew each other before then.
A little bit.
Internet friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for moving to Missoula for initially a bad, not a fun job.
Yeah, I was just packing some t-shirts into some bags and sending them out to the people who are listening to this, who ordered Pizza John shirts.
Yeah. Thank you for doing that.
No problem.
But now, new job.
Yes, new job, producer man.
So you're also, I just heard that you want to be at PodCon. Have you got your PodCon ticket?
I have not, actually. I'm planning on doing that whole Indiegogo thing soon, though.
Why? So explain to me why you've waited so that I can understand the psychology of people who haven't immediately bought their tickets.
For me, it is a budgetary reason that it, like, for this month's budget, it's not listed right there. So I'm going to wait until payday and be like, hey,
right
now I can write it into next month's budget.
Nice. So are you taking this advice from The Financial Diet, the YouTube channel you help produce? Or
it's been every week when I'm editing Financial Diet, I'm like, oh, I should be doing that. Like, I should have already been doing this thing and I'm not.
Yeah.
And then later on, they'll make another video being like, you know, guys, we already made a video about this thing that you should be doing by now. And I'm like, I'm not, though. They'd be so ashamed of me if they knew.
Yeah. You're getting on top of your stuff.
I'm trying.
That's good.
Yeah,
well,
trying.
I appreciate you considering your own budget first before the budget of my convention. That is the way it should be.
But then I'm getting the swag bag one.
Oh, yeah. So you're saving up for...
Yeah. You're doing like the, I think it's like the 125 tier or whatever.
Yeah. Because,
That seems like
price
a pretty
will
sweet
go
deal.
Up after the Indiegogo ends.
Oh, man. I got to get in there then.
Just so you know. All right. Well, did you bring a short poem for me today?
I did kind of bring a short poem.
Is it just the lyrics from a Green Day song?
No, but you're not that far off. This one, I'll read it first and then tell you who it's from.
Okay.
Dig through the graveyard, rub the bones against my face. It gets real nice around the graveyard once you've acquired the taste. And when the clouds do clear away, get a momentary chance to see the thing I've been trying to beat to death, the soft creature that I used to be.
Ooh.
That's off the new album Goths by the Mountain Goats.
Oh my God. Of course, we should only do John Darnielle lyrics as Dear Hank and John poems.
Like, I was like looking up like Walt Whitman things and all this other stuff, and I was like, oh, what should I do?
Yeah.
And then I realized all I've been listening to this week was the new Mountain Goats record, and I was like, well, clearly, there's got to be something on there.
It's pretty much all poetry, what that man does. I find that I sing a lot of Mountain Goat songs to my son as he is going to sleep because they are good lullabies.
Most of them are okay.
As long as you don't know what the words mean.
That's also helpful that he's young enough to not really understand them.
Like singing Love, 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 and Love, Love, Love has like a really sort of sweet refrain, but then it's all about really bad stuff.
And you don't want to sing like No Children to your child.
Uh-huh.
Especially once he starts understanding what the words mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I find that most of the songs that I sing to my child would not be good for him to be listening to.
When do you feel like you can...
All this, like, every... So I listen to popular music, so all of the like happy songs I know are fast and upbeat and not good lullabies. And all the lullaby songs are about death and breakups and car crashes and suicide. And it's just like, well, I guess that's what I'm singing.
When do you think you have to stop that? Like, what age?
I don't know.
Because he's going to start to like comprehend the tone maybe before he starts
But the tone is lovely.
Yeah.
There's like there's like a Paul Simon song. It's like the lyric like "Don't cry, baby, don't cry" is in there, and I feel like that's really
right.
It's a wonderful song, "Boring the Bubble," but like the first verse is about a suicide bombing, and you're like, okay, well, that's what's happening.
I mean, he has to learn sometime about the horrible things that exist in this world, and so what better way than Paul Simon?
Yeah. Well, Yes, and that's how I learned. That was my first exposure to terrorism. Was probably that very song.
I think a lot of us learn awful things through the music we listen to.
Yeah,
and
maybe how to deal with and process things as well. But I fear the day when I have to like sing Baby Beluga to my child because I like good music and I think that most kids' music is not good. But
when he's no longer entertained by the things you are entertained
right,
by.
But it's love. Like the majority of the songs I sing to my son. Nah, that was hard. Are They Might Be Giants songs, and they actually have kids' music.
Yes,
which is extreme, like super.
Let's say you can like find those artists who you really like who have also done kids' albums, like Kimmy Dawson and other people like that.
Yeah, totally. That's what I'm gonna have to do.
Yeah,
I think I'll be okay.
He will not hear Baby Beluga until he's like 42. He's like, what is this song? I've
God
never heard
for
this.
My father.
Yeah, who's Raffy?
And Catherine also really loves Sesame Street and like Jim Henson stuff. So like that's already up in the house, even though like he has no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
There's lots of Bert and Ernie happening.
Though.
And I'm a Bert and Ernie fan myself.
Yeah. I'm more of a Grover man myself.
Oh, yeah. What, really?
Yeah.
How you feel about Elmo?
Elmo's all right.
Yeah. I feel like Elmo is obviously very appealing to kids because he is an infant.
Yeah.
Like his character, whoever or who he actually is. I don't want to like break any walls here.
Well, it's part of my distaste for Elmo comes from there's a documentary called I Am Big Bird.
Yeah.
It's all about Carol Spinney, who is the voice and performer of Big Bird and has been since like day one.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of that documentary, it gets kind of sad because they start talking about that, like the fact that Big Bird has been the person of Sesame Street since like day one.
Right.
Kids think about Sesame Street. They think about Big Bird. He is their favorite. And then Elmo comes along and starts to be the new favorite because he appeals to a slightly younger audience than Big Bird.
Yeah.
And so Big Bird feels like pushed to the wayside.
Aww.
It's not.
I mean, there is nothing more sad than sad Big Bird.
Yeah.
Like there are many sad things in the world, but like picturing Big Bird sad.
Yeah. Like his real tall head just drooping a little
bit. Oh, God, stop.
Yeah.
Don't do it. I'm going to cry right here.
I would avoid watching that documentary if you don't want to see a lot of sad Big Bird talk.
Is there a lot of sad Big Bird?
Well, just Carol Spinney's had an interesting kind of hard life at some points. And so it's, gets a little sad.
Well, I think it might be worth watching anyway.
Watched it twice.
It sounds lovely.
It's great.
Wow. Okay. I feel like we should start with a sad question.
Oh, okay.
This one's
keep
from
the
Josh.
Train rolling.
Yeah. Who asks, dear Hank and Matt. I'm a teacher. This week, a colleague, friend, and mentor suddenly passed away. 2 days later, a different former colleague also passed away. I want to be there for my students, but I also very much am struggling on my own right now. How do I best support and care for my students when I feel crippled by my own sadness at this loss? Thanks for any advice, Josh. Starting out on a highest note.
Yeah.
First, Big Bird is sad. Now Josh is struggling.
Is also sad.
And also has to be there for... This is a hard thing when like you have a responsibility to people who exist in the world.
I think it also,
but
the context we don't have is how old the students are.
That's true.
Which matters a lot.
My question is like, are the students dealing with this loss as well? I think it's just something that's in Josh's life. So I don't know necessarily that the students are dealing with this, but maybe they are. Maybe it was a person at the school who died.
I had that experience in college where a professor of mine, she was married to another professor and he had passed away and none of us knew about this until she came into class one day, very distraught, obviously. And like told us all while she was crying, like,
wow.
That this happened. And
I feel like maybe there's another way to deliver that news.
Well, I mean, but it was personally for me, I felt like she was being very open and honest and raw with us. And it seemed like this is what she needed to
do. I'm not saying that it's like the wrong way to deliver it to you.
Yeah.
I'm saying like maybe it would have been easier for her to not have to do that, but maybe not.
Yes. I don't know.
I think that there is definitely an age thing. If it's like, hey, kids.
Hey, third graders.
Hey, third graders. I'm dealing with a lot of death right now.
Yeah. Oh, you don't know what that is? Let me teach you.
And I'm struggling with that, so I'd appreciate if you imagined me as a human being. And that's, like, the other thing is I never, until college, ever considered my teachers to be humans.
Yeah, I think most adults don't seem like humans when you're a kid.
Yeah.
Like, they seem like these all-knowing people who just spent all of their life working towards one course of knowledge.
Right,
like,
right.
They're, like, my Spanish teacher was just a Spanish teacher, and she never existed outside of Spanish class.
Yes.
But yes. Yeah, she had complicated things going on in her life.
And you imagine, or did yeah. she? Definitely.
She was doing online dating and all this stuff and having troubles and like, who knows what she was doing? I don't, because I didn't think she was a person.
Man, I tell you what, my Spanish teacher was definitely not doing online dating because that didn't exist.
There was some form, I bet. There was AOL chat rooms.
They're probably, first of all, she was happily married. So okay. Hopefully she wasn't doing any of that.
Well,
but I don't know how happily married she was. That's the thing.
You don't
I did
know.
Have a bit of a crush on her.
So you were like...
I was aware of her personal situation.
Yes, because you wanted to be... Like, you didn't need to be. She didn't bring it up, but you were like, hey, Senorita Susan, are you married?
Are you seeing anybody right now?
Yeah. Oh,
that's
you're married?
Not weird.
Okay.
That's not a weird question.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, yeah, in general, though, having having to deal with your own issues while there are other people relying on you can be either just crippling and anxiety-inducing, or it can help you sort of like say, I have to work through this and I have to be the person that this person needs me to be right now. And so that gives you a chance to sort of either distract yourself or find ways to get through it. And so like in some ways, like if there's a way to find strength in the need of your charges to need you to be something, that can be really good. It can get you out of bed when you otherwise don't want to get out of bed.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've dealt with this, being like in a managerial type position, having mm-hmm. like being a superior to other people at jobs. Like I've been a manager to people at jobs, and there are days you come into work and you don't feel like working, you don't feel like being mm-hmm. happy or leading a meeting or something like that, and you want to still have your coworkers
right.
and colleagues doing the job they need to do and feeling inspired, and you don't want to bring everyone down around
right.
you. So it's there is a somewhat of a strength to trying, like,
and
motivating those other people.
And sometimes putting on the brave face actually makes you brave. Sometimes it's you're like, I'm lying to myself and I hate it and I can't handle it. And
sometimes
in those situations,
impossible.
You like, you have to just deal. You have to find ways to deal with it. You have to find a professional to talk to. And like grief is like the number one reason people go talk to people who professionally help people work through problems. And so that's absolutely a suggestion and an option.
And a lot of jobs, I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily a lot of jobs, but hopefully a lot of jobs out there, if you go and talk to a supervisor or a colleague or something, they may be able to facilitate something where you could take a day off,
mm-hmm.
take a half day,
yeah,
and deal with this on your own if that's what you need.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully the people that you work for, the administrators at your school, will be understanding of that.
All right, this next question. Dear Matt and Hank, you may be aware of the conspiracy theory believed by 12 million Americans, which posits the presence of an ancient alien race of reptilian humanoids hiding amongst controlling humankind. According to this theory, there are countless reptilian human hybrids going about their daily lives who may not even be aware of their true heritage. Among the characteristics
Ooh.
Purportedly present in these hybrids are 1. A tall stature,
mm-hmm.
A love of space and science,
uh-oh.
A desire to seek wisdom or knowledge,
okay.
and a compassion for the fate of mankind.
Really?
It's very specific.
Yeah.
Reptilians also often have jobs which place them in the public
Uh-oh.
Eye. My question is for Hank. Are you aware that you may be a reptilian human hybrid? Thanks, from Bethany.
I thought the question was going to be, are you aware that Rhett of Rhett and Link is definitely a reptilian human hybrid?
You could both be a reptilian human
it's
hybrid.
It's true, but like Rhett could fit like several reptiles inside of him. He's like 6'8".
he's just 2 reptiles in a man suit.
He's wearing that Egger suit. First of all,
yeah,
I don't know. And I think that's
that's
interesting.
How do we find out?
I have cut myself and I have bled, human-looking blood.
Okay.
I have had surgery. People have, I had a hernia repair. I had a colonoscopy.
And they were never like, you know.
Yeah, they never cut me open and they were like, where's your diaphragm?
Yeah.
Like, you don't have a spleen. There's 8 hearts in here. None of that happened.
That's good.
But you never know how accurate these reptile people things are. And I... Also, but I would say that it seems like it's not a bad rap. So, like, you're tall, you love space and science, you seek wisdom and knowledge, you're compassionate for the fate of humankind, and you have a job in the public eye.
Aside from the whole controlling humankind thing, that seems like a pretty positive...
Hey, I would be like, I try to control humankind. That's one of my goals.
That's right. But in a positive way.
Right.
I think what they are
worried
about. I
have compassion for the fate of mankind.
I think, yeah. But anytime I've seen the reptilian conspiracy shared online.
Yeah, I haven't heard that part of the reptilian conspiracy, that they're kind of here to help.
Yeah.
Because if they're here to help, I'm totally down for it. Come, inhabit our bodies, reptiles. Get us through this very difficult period in our species' survival.
Does it say that it's easier now to pick out who's not a reptile?
Right. If they're not compassionate for the fate of mankind.
Yeah. Clearly not a reptile.
Yeah. I don't know that that's actually part of it. But if it is... Like frankly,
maybe they were trying to like cater this a little bit more towards you.
Yeah, maybe. But if that's the thing, like, I'm super down for it. And also, like, I'd
be okay finding out I'm a reptile.
Right. I don't want to find out I'm a Psylon and I'm here to destroy humans.
No, like a secret code that's been inside of you the whole time that like suddenly you can just flip a switch and it's like, oh no, now you're a jerk.
Right. Yeah, I don't want that.
No, that'd be bad.
As soon as you hear some classic rock song. Yeah. I think if I'm not, I'm as close as you can get.
Based on this description, yeah, you're pretty much like, you're definitely tall. Love space and science. Uh-huh. You got shows about both of those things, which puts you into the public eye.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that there are reptiles doing this on Earth. Is that okay? I hope that this exists.
This is one of those like Wikipedia wormholes I've definitely fallen into.
Yeah,
like those conspiracy theories.
Jobs.
Yeah, and like different ones, like flat Earth and all this stuff, where you fall into it and you want to try and understand the people who believe this and why they believe this.
Yeah,
and I think this is one of those where it's explaining away these people who are held to a higher regard and are out there in the public eye, or in politicians and celebrities, and they're like, well, clearly. They must be a reptilian alien race.
How else would Iggy Azalea have gotten popular?
Clearly an alien. An Australian rapper? Ha! No, alien rapper.
With a Georgia accent?
Yeah.
What is happening?
Nope, alien.
Definitely alien. I sort of have a hope that someday there will be a system that exists that is external to humans, that gives us some ability to like not have to make all of these very hard decisions that we are suddenly all tasked with. And maybe it already exists in the form of these reptiles. Like I love freedom. I'm a huge fan of freedom, but sometimes there is too much choice. And I love freedom, but I just want somebody to tell me where my wife and I are going for dinner tonight.
And for that to be a compassionate, nice choice.
Yes, until
they weren't
yes.
just like Taco Informed. Bell. Ha, gotcha.
I love Taco Bell. I want to give me some of those nacho chips
things
that are made out of chicken.
Mm.
I haven't had one yet. I'm so excited.
Neither have I.
I love Taco Bell.
Taco Bell is great. I don't know why I
but yeah.
chose, like, threw them under the bus.
So I don't know. In the end, I have no idea, because that's part of the conspiracy theory, is that apparently people aren't sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like that's most conspiracy theories.
Right.
Is that people aren't too sure, but they really want to believe. Are there any conspiracy theories that you are kind of like...
I mean, besides that, no. Not, yeah. I mean, are there?
I don't know. I feel like
not
you and I
really.
Are like a similar skeptical brain, and...
There's probably something that I'm like, but I don't. I haven't locked onto it at the moment.
Yeah, there's like... Oh, no, of course, reptile people and flat Earth and all this stuff, but maybe this one.
Like, I'd like to get one. I'd like to have a pocket conspiracy theory that's harmless and that I'm into.
I want to believe in Bigfoot.
Well, the thing is, there have been actual conspiracies.
Yes.
Like, Watergate was a conspiracy. You know, there's like the human experiments with LSD and, you know, giving American citizens diseases because they were not white and we wanted to do research on them, and like those conspiracies really existed and then they were uncovered, and like, so there probably are conspiracies that have not been uncovered.
So you're saying there is a Bigfoot?
No. I bet I would not. I'm totally down for aliens have visited Earth.
Okay.
I could be there for that. I'm not saying it's happened. I'm not saying it's likely, but like I'm also not saying it's impossible. Like,
yeah, there are a lot less UFO sightings now that we all have cameras in our pockets, surprisingly.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think any of the current like crop of evidence that there were UFOs make sense, because I think that alien races, if they are able to travel through interstellar space at manageable speeds, have technology advanced enough that we wouldn't like be like, hey, they crashed their ship on a planet, like something went wrong.
I used to be really obsessed with a lot of conspiracies when I was like 11 or 12, mm-hmm. and would just like watch endless VHS documentaries about these things. And at the end of the day, come to no conclusions and like not decide which side I'm on, which I feel like is maybe the good way to do that.
Probably, yeah.
To know about them, but not necessarily just dive in and believe all of them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think like, yeah, it can be very seductive and also like destructive. Because a lot of times the conspiracies now are like this reptilian one, for example, is tied up inside of, a fear of other people or certain groups of people.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, like I knew the Democrats were evil. They're space aliens.
Yeah.
That's, you don't want to go there necessarily. I have a question.
All right.
It's from Anonymous, who asks, Dear Hank and Matt, so I've been dating this guy for about 3 months, and he has snakes, and he went on vacation, and he asked me if I could water them. I like the idea of her watering the snakes, with a watering
just
can.
Just spritzing?
Just like wet them down. So I did, very carefully, with the venomous ones. How many snakes are there, and why are there any venomous ones? Anyway, but I accidentally left one container open, and the snake escaped, and I felt very bad and guilty. Eventually, he found it, and it was all right, but I basically felt like I killed someone's puppy. Of course, I already apologized, but what do you do when you do something terrible by accident? Any dubious advice would be greatly appreciated. Anonymous. What do you do, Matt?
Well, first of all, I want to say accidentally letting a venomous snake out of a cage is very different from killing a puppy.
Yes.
So don't.
Though it could result in the death of a puppy.
It could. That snake could have got a hold of Rex. And
as long as there's no puppies in the house.
Yeah.
It is different. But I understand for sure. Like there are mistakes you can make that are much bigger than the mistake you made. Like, for example, if we take this to a different level and say your friend asked you to feed their cat for a week and you forgot.
That's bad.
Like, that's, like, but it's not an impossible mistake to make.
No.
Which, I will say, piece of advice to the world, if you do that and you ask your friend to feed your pet, text them the first or second day and be like, how's Spotlight doing? That's a cute name for a cat.
That's not bad.
And then it just minimizes the chance that a small mistake that will have a tremendous friendship-ending result does not occur.
Especially...
And it's weird to call this a small mistake, because it is a huge mistake.
It could have been. I guess the mistake itself doesn't feel big to me. Because, yes, it got out, but everything ended up fine.
Well, no, I'm saying the cat. Like, if you don't feed a cat.
Oh, yeah, the cat one's bad.
Yeah, but, like, it's kind of still a small mistake in that it's something that just might happen, and it's not malicious, and it's not... Like, it's not something that's like an everyday activity that everyone is expected to do. It's just you spaced and you killed a cat, and that shouldn't be possible. I went to a weird place with this.
That's all right. But it reminds me of a time that you asked me to feed your cat.
Yeah.
And a thing happened while I was feeding this.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. You know about this. It's not a surprise. I'm not springing this on you here in the podcast. But I was going upstairs to get the dish, to put the food in. And as I was bringing it back downstairs, I tripped a little bit coming down the stairs, and I dropped the food dish and broke it into a few pieces.
I remember this.
Yes.
And then you went to PetSmart, and you bought the dish that looked as much like the dish you broke as possible, which was way overboard.
Right, but in my head, I was like, what if this was like... a weird birthday gift
like
for Cameo.
Like a cat heirloom?
Yes.
Like, it's passed down for four cat generations?
Yeah, like a weird family like heirloom for your cat that was really important. And I was like, I broke the one cat heirloom they have. And so I literally like went to the store And I couldn't find the exact same one, but I found one with like a similar pattern. And I remember texting Catherine and being like, hey, I'm sorry, I broke the cat dish, but here's this thing I bought. It looks similar. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I remember.
And she was like, it's not a big deal at all.
Big deal. We have another one.
Yeah.
But to Anonymous's question.
Yes.
Now that we've gone in lots of bad directions. When you make them, I think that the only thing you can do is feel real bad. And it sounds like that's what you're doing. So sometimes people are like, I don't want to have a bad feeling because like it's bad and I shouldn't have to have bad feelings. I think that you should have.
Yeah. You definitely need bad feelings from time to time.
Yeah. And I think that like understanding what you did wrong. Well, the other thing I want to say, Anonymous, you are afraid of these snakes.
Yeah, you were maybe not the best person to ask.
Well, also, how, if you're afraid of a snake, do you make the mistake of not keeping it under control?
And if there's like a bunch of them and they're venomous and you don't like them, that is a thing that first on the list should be make sure they are securely in their cage.
I had a snake when I was a kid, just a garter snake that we found.
Okay.
And like it became our pet snake. We had a friend who, when they came over, we had to cover the snake up so that she couldn't see it, which I always thought was very weird because you want to be able to see the snake. You want to know that's where it is.
Yeah. So you don't want the magic trick of pulling off that cover and being like, oh, the snake's gone.
I don't know where the snake is. Is it inside your pants?
Maybe.
I think that you handled it well.
Yeah. And I think just in that case, being honest with the person is the first thing you have to do and be like, hey, happened.
There's a missing snake. It's in your house somewhere.
And sure, they may not ask you to watch their snakes again.
Yep. Right. Well, in general, not even like the bigger question of being like, what do you do when you make a small mistake that could have had big consequences and you feel really bad about it? And sometimes terrible bad things happen and like it, you have to like move on in a different way with your life. And sometimes in this case, it doesn't seem to have like, just because it might have had a severe consequence doesn't mean that it did.
Right. And you can't undo it.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, like being honest with the person, telling them what you did, that you're sorry for what you did, but that like, you'll try your hardest not to do it again.
That's right.
I don't know what to, it's hard because when you make those mistakes, you feel like the worst person.
Yeah.
And like they're never gonna forgive you, and that you'll never be trusted to do anything again.
It's sometimes telling. Like if you've had this done to you, how did you respond? And like I've definitely had times when people have made big mistakes in my life.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes I find it easy to forgive them, and sometimes I don't. And it's sort of like it becomes up to them, and you can continue feeling bad about it. But it seems like the decision has been made. You are forgiven. Good work.
Our next question comes to us from Riley, who says, Dear Matt and Hank, I work with a relatively small number of people, and today a coworker told me and some other coworkers that she was expecting a baby. At the end of the day, I was talking to a different coworker, and I said something like, oh, isn't so-and-so's big news exciting? Only to find out that they had not heard it yet.
Yeah.
I had assumed that the woman was telling everyone at the office the news, but then I wasn't sure and didn't want to spoil it, so I awkwardly said something about how they would probably find out soon. Now, I feel bad about having said anything. What is the proper office baby news etiquette? As fathers who were formerly expecting children... Oh, this was for you and John. As far as I'm... It's like, I am not a kid. I do not have a kid, is what
I'm
I mean.
I'm not a kid.
Or do not have a kid. As fathers who were formerly expecting children, your dubious advice is welcomed. Well, I will try my best to help.
Well, I mean, so first of all...
Yeah.
There is some etiquette that falls on the teller... And I think you can do it however you want, obviously. But if you're going to tell the office, you might want to tell the whole office. Like, if it's going to be known. And probably you're fine. Probably it was intended for it to be public news.
Yeah, it's not. Unless they said, hey, don't tell anyone.
But I don't tell. I try. I've let baby news slip before, and I feel terrible about it. But I try to just never tell anybody about anybody else's pregnancy. And I'm in a place where I have now experienced about 8,000 friends getting pregnant because I'm old. a lot of my friends are family types. And my rule has become just don't bring it up unless they're like 9 months pregnant. Yeah. It's like the same rule for like asking whether or not a person is pregnant. Like,
yeah, like saying, like, what do?
You ask that question when there's a baby coming out.
Yeah.
Like when...
If they have like an it's a girl sign next to their very large 9-month belly, that's when you can ask.
Yeah, there should be like a decal that people can put on that says, yes, I am pregnant. Just to be clear.
Just on any item of clothing, you just slap that
slap
on.
Slap it on. Yeah, just a little sticker. The clothing sticker. Is that how it works? Or maybe just probably a tattoo is a bad idea because it's a temporary situation.
Because you're not always pregnant.
No, you don't. It's not like once you are forever.
Yeah, I don't think that's how it works. How did you deal with this when you were telling people, though?
I don't remember anything. The sleep deprivation of the last 6 months has made it impossible to remember anything longer than 2 days.
All right.
So I don't know. I think that we did like a... And this is the thing. Like, we did a big announcement email at some point. Like, mm-hmm. we told people, like, our best friends early on. And then when it was the time when they say, like, the chances of miscarriage have gone way down. Yeah. So it's like, you don't have, maybe you aren't going to have to explain if something bad goes wrong to as many people. It's not as likely that that will happen. Then... so then we did like a big announcement email. And of course, no matter how long we thought about who was on that email, we were leaving out people who we knew, like later we were like, oh, of course we should have had that person on. And then they feel like we're not important. I should probably mute my computer. Of course we're not important. And I'm so sad.
Yeah.
But like, of course I didn't say that, but I felt very bad for not.
Yeah. And especially if they find out in a weird way and they come back to you and they're like, yeah, I had to hear it from Tammy. Like, yeah, Tammy mentioned just offhand. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you hear about Hank and Catherine.
Yeah. And that's and so like it's always going to be somewhat a grapevine thing. And that's fine. I was just hanging out with a friend of mine who said that we hadn't seen each other in a while. And they said, the last time we saw you, we were pretending we didn't know you were pregnant because they had found out through someone they shouldn't have found out from.
Oh.
And they were like, we were hanging out with them and they were like, I guess we shouldn't congratulate them.
They haven't told us yet.
They haven't told us.
Yeah.
So we knew and they weren't even telling us.
I remember you told the office kind of an all at once deal in a big meeting. You're like, hey everyone, this news.
That was exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. And then like a day or two later, there was a guest in from out of town to work on some SciShow stuff with all of us. And we were all out having drinks and you and Catherine were not there.
Mm-hmm.
And this person asked the group, like, oh, do you think Hank and Catherine will ever have kids? And all of us just stopped, looked at each other and went, and I like turned, I was like, I don't know.
The person was like,
yeah, I think it was very clear that in that moment there was some information they were not being given. And to be fair, I think you like probably told this person during that week, but at that time I did not think they knew, and it was very clear when they asked that question that they did not know. And none of us reacted well in that situation.
The question is, did I have a baby? Or did I have a human reptilian hybrid?
Oh, no. Well, it'd be like a quarter reptile.
I don't know how it works.
Well, because Catherine's not reptile.
She's not super tall.
Yeah.
She's compassionate in fairly in the public eye, though. So who knows?
Yeah. Compassionate for mankind.
I don't know how it works.
Maybe that original question asker can write into us and let us know if they think Catherine's a reptile.
Or am I baby, too?
Oh, yeah. That's important. Yeah. We need to know to... Like, should so I? You can know how to raise him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, does he need, like, a heating lamp?
Should I water him?
Yeah. Can we hire a question asker from before to come water Oren for you?
Don't leave his cage open.
Yeah. He's venomous. Maybe.
Maybe. I've been bit by him several times.
But if you're a reptile, is it going to affect you?
It's true. He should bite you and we'll see what happens.
I'm okay with not doing that test.
You're probably a reptile, too, anyway.
Oh, man.
Probably.
I hope so.
If I have
friends who are reptiles, I also want to be a reptile.
We don't have anyone on the podcast who's not.
Oh, well, good.
It's one of the things. What is it called? I don't know.
It's at the top of my resume. Reptile video maker.
That's good. It's important to distinguish yourself from other candidates when submitting a resume. And so putting reptilian on there is especially if you're applying to a place that is led by reptilians. Matt, do you want to answer a really hard question?
Sure.
We're going to go to a place.
All right. We started off with a super dark death one, so let's go super deep.
Dear Hank and John slash Matt. When I read slash imagine characters, I imagine them as white, unless they are specified to be otherwise. Is this personal bias or is it racism? Hoping it's the former, Maggie. Well, first, I don't... Boy, are the definitions of these words not good enough to cover all of the things that
yeah.
they
We're not
are
just
going to
say one or the other and then walk away from this question.
So a while back on Dear Hank and John, we had a listener who wrote in who was from somewhere in Africa and who said that in a weird way, they weren't black until they moved to America. Because in their old country, they had the default complexion. And then in the new country, they suddenly were not that. And they had to sort of live in, like, come to terms with not being the default. And in my culture in America, which is basically an extension of Western European culture, white is the default race. And that's, like, this idea of a default thing is kind of hard to get your brain around, but it once you look at it, you see some things. So the racist part, so racist is a strange and difficult word. Let's talk about it. So when I think of a white person, the most important part, like the most, like the identifying characteristic of them, the thing that stands out, isn't their whiteness. It's not the color of their skin, because like that's what I'm expecting. It's some other identifier that they have probably applied to themselves. It's like they're a, like a hipster, or they're a hippie, or they're a bro, or they're a nerd. Like you like okay. look at them and you see a thing that's like they're like an identity that they have chosen.
You're like, oh, look at that
of.
White dude who's a hipster.
Right. You yeah yeah. You are you first see something. Like, it's not the first thing you see. You see something else, and usually it's something that they've kind of chosen for themselves.
Yeah,
and it's not always the case. So there are other things that can other people, like disability or stuff like that. Size is also one where like it can suddenly be the first thing you see about a person. Mm. But that's not like often for people of color, people who aren't white. They're like. Because that is a non-default thing, it's the first thing you see about them. So instead of seeing an identifier that they constructed themselves, you might, or I might, see a black person or an Asian person like as the first thing I see, like their blackness or their Asianness, and then immediately just sort of like take the set of stereotypes for that thing, their skin color, rather than the set of stereotypes for their like just sort of collection of their aesthetic and clothes and haircut and whatever, that we are really good at recognizing that pattern because that's what we're good at. We're good at recognizing patterns. Mm-hmm. So there's this difference. Like it's not racist in the, I hate people who aren't like me or who have a different race than me kind of way. It's racist in the humans are pattern recognition machines and skin color is much more likely to be a dominant variable in your pattern recognition when it's not the default color. Kind of way. So it's not a manufactured flaw that you have built and created and it's been created by your culture necessarily. It's more of a innate flaw, like more of a, like a thing that is wrong with you that's just sort of that all people have. Like it is just a kind of laziness. Because
I would say some of it feels like it's built up by culture around you though, because it like it depending is, on where you live, where you grow up, who you're surrounded by, your defaults are different.
Definitely. Yes.
And I feel like I've definitely had this, and sometimes it slaps me in the face when I realize that I'm doing it, similarly mm-hmm. to like the question asker, where you're reading something, and then five chapters in, they'll describe a physical feature mm-hmm. that you did not anticipate, and it might be skin color, it might be height, it might be size. And
it might be like gender often, too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh.
Like, you hear the word doctor, and then, like, the picture in your head is of a white man.
Right, and if you say, like, a teacher or something mm-hmm. like that, like, or a nurse.
Yeah.
Like, people, a lot of people defaultly, like, will picture women. And it's a thing that I think you're doing the right thing, question asker, mm-hmm. in acknowledging it and realizing that it is an issue.
Right.
And a lot of people aren't aware or capable of doing that because... they are fine with their default being white or male and mm-hmm. hearing the word doctor and going like, oh yeah, white guy. Right. And a lot of people are...
and just, we're not fine with it, but just don't question it. Don't like, just...
yeah, but even when they have it pointed out to them, some people are like, well, yeah, like, yeah, that's what I think. That's my default. Big deal.
The other thing is that like, so there's this thing that some writers think like, oh, I'll just won't point out what race anybody is, and that solves the problem of
not,
me writing
though.
In a like racist way. It does not.
No.
Because if as long as you're writing for a Europe, like a Western European-ish audience, like there's always going to be the assumption that all of the people in your books are the default race.
Yeah.
But I also like pointing out when someone is white, because it then says, hey, like, it's not like you have to tell me one way or the other. Like,
yeah,
especially give me some clue.
If it's a white author who is writing like sans race, expecting people to just assign a race, it's like, well, you're writing from a white person's point of view these characters. Like, you can't just expect people to apply.
Yeah, the idea that there's because race matters. Like,
yes.
People who are not white in America experience their non-white, so I am a white dude, so I'm talking about what I've heard from my non-white friends. Mm-hmm. Like, they experience their non-whiteness daily in a way that I very rarely experience my race.
Yeah, it's completely eye-opening when you just talk to someone about this and you realize how much they have to think about this every single day, every hour, every minute. And again, as a white dude, I don't think about this stuff ever. And it took me a long time in my life.
It's interesting, like, at the moments when I do, how like kind of defensive and attacked I get.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, it must be interesting to like feel that way all the time.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think especially like I get defensive because I don't experience it that often. And so when people are like, why, like, frickin' white guys, I'm like, well, not.
Yeah.
Oh, I just did it.
Oh, no.
I did the thing.
Because your default is comfort and being the top of the totem pole, like, kind of thing. And it's just, it's good to have those things pointed out to you.
Yep.
And like how you react to them is very important.
Yep.
And acknowledging that you could be wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And you probably are wrong about a lot of this stuff.
Hey, speaking of being wrong about stuff, I want to read you this. Just this. This isn't a question. It's just a statement. So a couple episodes ago, and this didn't come up in the last episode just because we recorded that one too fast to have gotten comments. We were backlogging so that John could go on a writing vacation, which is why he's not here today. This is from Ashini.
I don't know. I saw a picture of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on Instagram.
It's an important inspiration.
It's going to be hard to write with all that noise going around.
Hey, Green Brothers, but mostly Hank, because John wasn't there. Good. Well, John isn't here today either. In a recent episode, someone asked a question about women of the Islamic faith who cover their heads and how this is a symbol of oppression, and that made me feel a little icky. While I am not Islamic myself and therefore not exactly qualified to address this debate, neither were we, to be clear, this semester in Sociology of Women, we read two articles that explained how covering can be an expression of choice, liberation, and control for Muslim women in Western society, as well as an assertion of their right to belong in the community. I've attached them to this email because I think they're worth the read. While there are places in the world where women are forced to cover, that does not mean that the hijab is a symbol of oppression for all Muslim women, and I think it's harmful to Muslim women and otherizing to make that sort of blanket assumption. Victory for the forces of awesome, Ashini. And we will put those articles on the Patreon if you want to check them out. They are both helpful in understanding that the source of a tradition is not necessarily the meaning of a tradition anymore.
Yeah, and I think they really got the point that at the end there where they say it's harmful to make a sort of blanket assumption.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much true about everything.
Yes.
But especially like in this case, like unless you have talked to this person and understand why they are doing what they are doing, making any assumption about the reason they're doing it.
Yeah. There was another person who wrote in who made a really good point. I think it may have been on Twitter, who was like, it's interesting to me. So the question was from someone who was not Muslim, who wrote in to be like, is it okay for me to be okay with this system that seems very patriarchal to me and that has patriarchal roots, because I'm trying to be understanding of someone's faith? Or and a person on Twitter made the case, like, why are you writing into a podcast that is hosted by two non-Muslim dudes about that? Why don't you ask someone who is Muslim?
Yes.
And try to find information from somebody who is, like, making this choice in a world where they aren't being forced to make the choice. They're, you know, expressing themselves in the way that they want to. They're dressing themselves in the way that they want to.
Yeah.
Which is a good point. And which is why, like, I probably wouldn't have taken that question on if I wasn't being co-hosted with a person who's from a faith that has similar rules.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I really feel like talking to, I mean, not obviously going at someone and being like, why do you wear that?
Right.
That's not the way to go about it. But if you have a friend who you feel comfortable having that conversation with.
Right. Or like there are like sources yeah. on the internet of Muslim people who have talked about this and
right.
maybe going looking for those sources, or, you know, maybe going to like look for people who are advocates, like who are Muslim people who are vocal advocates
yes.
and have conversations and answer questions, which I think is important, because we do need to have complex discussions about this stuff, because just saying, oh, well, they're different from us and they can do whatever they want because they're different from us is not a good policy. And everyone knows that.
Yeah.
Because if you take that to its logical conclusion, it's bad. but saying like they're different from us and that like and I'm not sure that I like this, and then saying like, so maybe somebody can explain it to me, is a better way than saying, so let's write to my, like, let's talk about this with a bunch of people who don't have any of the context.
Right. Like, I think that happens a lot when you'll bring stuff up with a group of friends who you're asking about something like this, like hijabs or other things, mm-hmm. and you'll ask your group of friends who none of them are Muslim and none of them
yeah.
like have insight yeah. into this question, but you all start to discuss it and form opinions mm-hmm. and have ideas. And then hopefully at some point you realize maybe we're not the best people to be figuring this out.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe we should reference some outside sources
mm-hmm.
and take their word on it.
Yep. All right. Matthew, we've been going for quite a while now. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, this podcast is brought to you by questionable assumptions. Questionable assumptions among friends who have no idea what they're talking about. Driving forward confusion for hundreds of thousands of years.
This podcast is also brought to you by Taco Bell.
Mm.
Not that bad if your reptile overlords tell you to eat there, just so you know.
This podcast is also brought to you by Escaped Snakes. Oh. Escaped Snakes. Possibly your reptile overlords. We're not sure, but also make sure you water them so that they'll grow.
It keeps them happy and they will rule in a happier way.
That's correct.
This podcast is also brought to you by the feeling of accidentally killing someone's puppy.
Oh my God.
Not that bad unless you actually do it.
The feeling is fine.
The feeling's bad. I will give you that. It's not great, but it's a lot better than actually doing it.
All right. Oh, well, we got one more question before we get to the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. It's going to be a long podcast, Matthew. I hope that you don't have anything else to do today.
I had a lot to do, but it's okay. That's not true at all. I was playing video games before I came here.
Okay, good. This one's from Anonymous. Oh, man. We hit a lot. We're going to hit a lot. Like, this is going to be mostly serious questions today.
Yeah.
Oh, my. I'm going to ask one. Okay, we're going to do two questions. Two more questions.
Two more questions.
We'll end on a lighter one than this.
Gotcha.
Dear Hank and John, and Matt, I'm 17 and I've been homeschooled my whole life. I'm graduating high school next year and I feel terribly uneducated. My mom stopped teaching me and giving me things to do years ago and is too busy with her new full-time job to help me with anything now. So my education has almost entirely fallen on me. I've been trying to educate myself, but I'm really struggling. I'm very behind in math, history, writing, and science, like years behind. I really want to go to college, but I don't know even how to write a paper. This causes a lot of stress and anxiety in my everyday life. I'm ashamed and embarrassed of how little knowledge I have and often feel like it's my fault for being so behind. Is there any hope for me? Can I get the education I deserve? Are there people that I can reach out to get help from? Sick of being unprepared and behind in life. Anonymous. This made me a little bit mad.
Yeah?
Yeah.
At
mom.
At mom, yeah.
Yeah, like if you got too busy to continue this tremendous responsibility you have taken on, there is an institution
yeah.
available for free to take it on for you.
That's the reason it's there.
It's called school. It's called the normal default option.
Yeah, the homeschooling, I feel like, is sometimes people who feel like they can do it better.
Yeah, if you
than
can do it better.
School. But if you're clearly not doing that, maybe don't.
And what? So I don't want to psychoanalyze your mom too much, but a thing happens and it's happened to me, happens to everybody, where you are in a situation where things are getting worse every day, but recognizing that you are, that you have made the mistake you made, recognizing that you are, have to like face up to it, is so upsetting that, and like also time consuming and also shame inducing, that you don't want to recognize that it's happened. And in a longer version of this, Anonymous goes on to say that they're not blaming their mom, and that they like their mom a lot and that their mom is great. But it, this seems to me a situation where your mom got in over her head and
and
does not want to face up to
acknowledges it to herself and thinks about this a lot. And it, maybe it does weigh on her.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know what,
because it's a pretty big deal
about it.
I have to tell you, like, Anonymous, this is a, it is not hopeless. Absolutely not. There is plenty of hope for you. But it's a pretty big deal, the situation you've been put into. And it is also an opportunity. And I hate to say this this way, but like, if you think about it as like, what are you going to write in your college admissions essay? Are you going to say, I love my mom very much, but she dropped the ball, and so I had to do X, Y, and Z, like two really big adult things where I took charge of my life so that I could get back on top of this. And I was 17 years old, and I wrote into this dumb podcast where they gave bad advice, and I decided to take charge of my life and be kind of the adult that my mom wasn't being. And I called the school system, I called school administrators, and I was like, I need to get into school. I know I'm a little old, but maybe I can start junior year, and so that I'm not too behind, and maybe I'm going to be a little older, and maybe I'm going to have to work harder, but I'm going to do it. And or like, I decided to take some writing classes and to really dedicate myself to those, to take a GED class and to really knock it out of the park and make sure that I got like 100% on the GED exam, and so that I could move forward with my life despite the fact that this thing kind of happened to me. And then I had to push through it. And that's a good college admission story. Like, they're looking for people who have, you know, taken the reins in life a little bit and not just sort of like are falling and tumbling down the path of the thing that happens to you as a child, but that is like a college bound child.
Yeah. Trying to get in and be like, yeah, this thing happened to me. I'm not where I should be.
Right.
But help.
Yeah.
Like, isn't necessarily showing that you took the initiative, whereas you have that opportunity now to take a year, take some courses, either getting into a school or taking some like private classes somewhere that you can get into, or a GED program or something like that. There are plenty of resources out there.
Yeah.
That
and,
are,
and like, ideally, like, you'll be able to have like a good talk with your mom about this where you can say like, hey, like, I don't, like, you in your email, you seem very adult. You seem very connected to how this is making you feel. And so, like, I have a lot of, like, I have a, like, nothing but hope for you. Like, I think that you, I think that you're going to be able to get on top of this. You seem to be a good writer already. Like, this is a well, it was a well-composed email, and it was thoughtful in a way that makes me feel like you know, you're smart, you're on top of things. So I think that you need to have like a pretty serious talk with your mom and be like, I need to get, like, I can't just self-motivate myself. I can't just watch Khan Academy videos and be done.
And while I think, like, I have never, like, personally known someone who's gone through this, I know that this person is not the only one.
Yeah, it is.
There are communities out there, I'm sure, online, of people just like you who have been through this exact same experience. And I'm sure it's been going on since homeschooling has been a thing, where people feel unprepared.
Right. I mean, I did a little bit of research, and there's like, there's a huge scale of how this might go. There are people who come out of homeschooling illiterate. And so, like, I can tell that you're not there. Like,
right.
You are. And there are people who go to college who are tremendously unprepared, who have gone through public school. And
right. That's why placement tests exist, and they can help you. Like, even if you end up deciding to go to a college instead of like taking GED courses and stuff like that first, a lot of colleges will work with you and shape your curriculum around what you are prepared for. They're not just going to throw you into something. If anything, college advisors will tell you, hey, maybe you shouldn't do all of these courses or this hard of a course in your first year. Like, they are there to help you and to try and like get you the best education possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So I will say that you might not be as far behind as you think you are. There are a lot of people who are pretty far behind when they go off to college. But I would also say, like, be ready to work more than the rest of the people. And like, and that's going to make a huge difference. And people will know, like your professors and your teachers will know when you're working harder because you have some stuff to make up for. And don't be afraid of that, because like working hard is the best skill you can develop.
And I think talking to those other people who have been through this, if you can reach out to them,
you can find some,
it'll make you feel less embarrassed about this, because you won't feel like the only person who's ever gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
Because you definitely are not.
Definitely not. All right. Our last question. It comes from Casey, who asks, "Dear John and Hank and Matt, I was talking with a good friend of mine of 6 years. When we stumbled onto the idea of space travel to Mercury, my argument was, along with several obvious facts, that Mercury is too close to the sun, but my friend proceeded to raise his voice, calling me an idiot, because you would just go in the middle of winter, and at night the sun would be like 80 degrees. Do you have any advice for what to name my dog when I move to Canada to avoid my former friend from Casey?"
That took a turn. It's not exactly where I expected that question to end.
I did have to read it twice before I understood the implication.
Like, you had to make sure that someone didn't accidentally delete half of the questions. And be like, what? Oh, this is the same person asking the same question.
Yep,
okay.
Yep. So, first, there's two things happening. You think your friend is an idiot because they don't understand Mercury. Your friend thinks you are an idiot because they are wrong about how Mercury works. I'm going to be the third person and tell you that you're both idiots because you're both wrong. Mercury is hot on the side that's facing the sun, but during the time when it's not facing, so it rotates.
Yeah.
So there is the whole planet does occasionally experience the tremendous iron melting heat.
Not great for travel.
Not great. But on the side that's dark, it is winter,
but
and
like
it is very cold,
right? Like deathly cold.
Yeah,
not like 80 degrees.
Not
hanging
80,
out.
But I will say that if one side is hot and one side is cold, somewhere on the planet, it's 80 degrees.
You just have to stay in that spot.
You just have to follow it around
because
it moves.
You're gonna need a real fast Mercury car.
And in science fiction, there is there's an idea of like a train that goes all the way around Mercury, and the train has a city on it. And the city moves along that area of Mercury that is neither in the sun or in the dark. It is, well, it's in the dark, but it's like close enough that it's still cool. And like if it stops moving, everything catches on fire. So
let's not go to Mercury, probably.
Right.
It seems complicated.
But what I want to say is that everybody in this situation, me, Casey, and Casey's friend, all assumed that the person was an idiot and dumb and wrong.
This is true.
And so friendship should end then? Or should both Casey and Casey's friend and me think maybe it's more complicated than I think it is? And I do agree, Casey, that this is frustrating that your friend got mad at you for being an idiot, but you should not be frustrated at your friend for not knowing something, because that is the joy of living on Earth, is that we are all always learning and knowing more things.
And clearly, this dog's name is going to be Mercury.
That's a good dog name.
Like, that's your only choice at this point.
Is there... So Pluto is a dog.
Yeah.
Is there another dog named after a planet?
Uranus.
Goofy?
No, Goofy, I don't think we've discovered that planet yet.
I bet there's a planet named after Goofy.
Planet
Not
Goofy.
A planet, but some astronomical object.
I don't know. We always name them just weird number combinations now.
Ceres is a dog.
Is it?
I think so.
Is there a dog named Ceres?
I think so. I'm Googling it.
I'm going through all the planet names now. Like, I mean, people have definitely named their dogs like Venus or Neptune. Neptune's not a bad dog name either. But this case, I think to really stick it to your friend, since you're going to move away because of him.
Right, Mercury.
Yeah.
Ceres is not a dog. Ceres is the goddess of agriculture and grain crops, fertility and motherly relationships. Originally the central deity in Rome's so-called plebeian or Aventine triad.
So if you've got a real motherly dog, name it Ceres.
It's good. I don't know why I thought Ceres was a dog. Cerberus.
That's probably where you're going.
So that's just what I wanted to say. Matthew Gatos, do you have some news from AFC Wimbledon?
I do have some news from AFC Wimbledon.
Is it good news?
Eh. I decided to not go with the scores or the trades or anything like that.
Okay.
I wanted to bring a little bit of a twist to the news from AFC Wimbledon here. So it has been a year since that magical night in Lancashire. That I'm probably pronouncing 100% correctly. But this was a dramatic win against Accrington to mark the occasion. AFC Wimbledon, on their delightfully named auction website, AFC Bay.
Is it really?
No, it's just, it's a link to eBay, but they call it AFC Bay. So like, go visit AFC Bay. They're auctioning off some items.
Okay.
That benefit the club. Because, you know, AFC Wimbledon is like owned by the fans.
I should get something for John.
Well, you have two great options that I'm going to tell you about right now. One is a pair of shorts from that game that were worn by the Montserrat and Messi, Lyle Taylor.
What?
These are the shorts. I don't know if they've been washed. Not sure.
I hope not.
But they are currently going for £52 on AFC Bay.
Okay. How long is the?
It goes through May 28th, I believe. So if anyone out there is interested in getting Lyle Taylor's shorts,
you have very little time because this is going to come out on like the 27th.
There you go. If you
no, it won't.
Are of
I don't know when it will. I don't know.
If you are of a slightly larger stature and would like a different pair of shorts, they also have a pair of Adebayo Akinfenwa's shorts.
Wow.
So you can go pick those up, which are actually currently going for a higher £56.
Okay.
With 9 bids. So 9 people have already bid on his shorts. There are also things like signed photographs of first team players, coaching staff. You can get programs, signed posters, DVD box sets. There's lots of options. But they're having a cool auction going on right now to benefit AFC Wimbledon.
And I will say, this is great. This is what good AFC Wimbledon news, Matthew. Wonderfully done. There is a Twitter that is just the AFC Wimbledon eBay Twitter.
Is it at AFC Bay?
It is AFC Wimbay.
That's not as good.
Because apparently AFC Bay was taken, I assume. Let me look and see what AFC Bay is. Probably something with absolutely no tweets, but that is how Twitter works. AFC Bay tweeted, oh, never.
Oh, they can get that.
So I don't know why they don't use AFC Bay, you guys.
I do love that at the bottom of this article talking about all the auction items, it says, there are plenty of other non-football items that you can also bid for, including signed footballs.
Maybe they're actual like American footballs, and so like it's not related. It's a different kind of football.
It's a different kind of football.
Oh my goodness.
So do you have some good news for us from Mars?
I have a little bit of Mars news, yes. So Mars, as we now know, was once a wet place.
Right.
Some scientists have done some science.
That's what they do.
As they are wont to do.
Yeah, they have to, like every so often, to keep up that title.
And have determined that using basic physical principles to understand the relationship between the atmosphere, raindrop size, and rainfall intensity, we have shown that Mars would have seen some pretty big raindrops.
How big?
They would have been able to make more drastic changes to the surface of Mars than earlier fog-like droplets.
Okay.
How big? An atmospheric pressure equivalent to that of Earth's, for example, Martian raindrop would likely have maxed out about 7.3 millimeters, so about 1 millimeter larger than current Earth drops.
Which doesn't sound like a lot, but you would notice it.
So this is the thing, that, like, you know this, but it kind of is a little counterintuitive that raindrops have size. Is that wrong?
It's not a thing I've ever thought about.
Yeah. But they do. Like,
yeah, there's big old fatty rain.
Yeah, in Florida, you like walk outside and you get hit by like 8 raindrops and you're soaking wet.
Yeah.
Here, you can walk all the way to work, it's raining the whole time, and you're like,
I was at a barbecue yesterday, and it rained for like an hour, and none of us went inside because it was fine.
Yeah, it's just very dry here. But the rain does fall out of the sky because it is heavier than air. The largest recorded raindrop on Earth was about an inch in diameter.
That's big.
It's a big raindrop. Like, that's like a, that's like pow.
I just,
well, it hurt. It's like a hail.
Where did they measure it? Like, how?
Right, yeah.
Because I feel like
I think that couldn't
have been the one, and they just happened to be waiting there with a little measurement tool, being like, oh, good,
just
we
like,
got it.
Just like holding up a little ruler. Yeah. No, I think what happened is
the guy
is,
skydiving next to the rain, measuring different raindrops.
That's not even how you want to do it, though, because you don't want to measure up there, because they're going to be biggest when they hit the ground.
That's true.
But yeah, I think what happens is they're looking at how many raindrops are falling, and then they measure the amount of water that's collected, and then they infer from that how big the drop would have been.
Right, that makes more sense.
Rather than like using a high-speed camera or something that's like got a ruler behind it.
Get the slow-mo, guys. We got to find out how big these raindrops are.
Quote, there will always be some unknowns, of course, such as how high a storm cloud could have risen into the Martian atmosphere, but we made efforts to apply the range of published variables for rainfall on Earth. It's unlikely that rainfall on early Mars would have been dramatically different from what's described in our paper. Our findings provide more definitive constraints about the early history of water and the climate on Mars. So they're doing scientific analysis, making models of how the rain would have happened. Because it's interesting, like on a planet with less gravity, you have more up, like the like if you have the same amount of atmosphere and more and less gravity, then like all that stuff sticks around up there for longer. Because what happens with raindrops is they get blown around, and that's what, like, as long as they're getting blown around in the cloud, they're picking up more water, and then when they fall out, that's like that's as big as they're gonna get. When they get heavy enough to fall, that's when they fall.
Right.
But if there's less gravity, then it takes a little longer for them to get heavy enough to fall.
Hmm.
Which affects not just how big the raindrop is, but the geology of Mars.
So when you first said they were there slightly larger, or they were larger than Earth's, I was picturing like a fist-sized raindrop just like pounding Earth.
It's ready to be like, ah,
yeah,
this got like, punched we by cannot, the sky.
Yeah, I'm glad we were not on Mars then.
Oh, goodness gracious. What did we learn today, Matthew?
Well, I want to know, Hank.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the rain?
You know, I made that joke.
Yeah.
On an episode of Holy Freaking Science.
I know, I was there. That's why I brought it up. Because we were the only two who knew that song. I learned that Hank, and maybe me, who knows, might be a reptile.
Human hybrid. That Matthew Gatos felt really bad about breaking my catfish.
I felt so bad. I learned that while Mercury maybe isn't the best place to visit for a vacation, maybe is a great name for a dog in Canada.
I think that's like also, I like it's not so easy to move to Canada as you may think.
Yeah, just running away from your friend. You can't just bolt across the border with your dog in hand.
I'm seeking asylum. We had an argument about Mercury. And I learned that got to be careful with those baby announcements. Got to tell everybody at once or you're going to cause an awkward situation.
Or don't tell anybody ever and just let it happen.
Yeah, people will be like quietly eyeing your belly or
asking
your
friends,
wife's belly
like,
and being like, what?
Are they is pregnant? That, like, I don't know. They never told me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good. And then not even tell them after the kid's born, and people will be like, "Is that yours?"
Yeah,
I'm not telling. Yeah. That's my bad.
I feel
policy.
Like you should have done that now. Like you should have like not told anybody about Oren, and then like in 12 years, just be like, "Oh yeah, that's my son." And he's like, "What's up?"
That would have been difficult.
Very difficult.
It would have been really hard to justify the paternity leave. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dear Hank and John. Thank you for joining me, Matthew.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
Good. Let's go to Taco Bell.
Yeah. Gotta get some of those naked chicken chips or whatever they are.
Yeah. How is it naked? They're just... It's not like there's... They're fried, so they're not even naked.
And they're not even chips.
Covered in bread.
There's only one way to find out. We need to do the science like the scientists do and eat some of these non-chips.
This episode of Dear Hank and John is produced by Rosianna Hulse-Rojas and Sheridan Gibson. Our editor is Nicholas Jenkins. Victoria Bongiorno is our head of community and communications. Hey, thanks, Victoria. And our music is by the great Gunnarola.
Woo.
As they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.